This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mitt Romney won Florida tonight. He won it big, too. And so on the broadcast this evening, where things go from here, what we're calling the real economy, what actually matters in this election. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, January 31st. Good as always to have you with us. And it didn't take long for the counting to be done in Florida tonight. All the major networks called the GOP primary for Mitt Romney just about as the polls closed. Here's what we know about how he won. Exit polls show 2 out of every 3 voters said the debates were important in helping them make up their minds. Electability was a big one. 45% of Florida Republicans said the most important thing was who could beat President Obama in the fall. Not surprisingly, we like this next number best. 62% said the key issue was the economy, how they're living, what their prospects are, how they're going to get by. It's what we've started calling the real economy, away from the hype and the politics. So as the campaigns regroup and re-strategize, we're going to start our election coverage by taking you to 2 states where the real economies are quite different. Differences that point out how big the challenge of getting the whole country economically healthy really is. We've picked Nebraska and Nevada. Nebraska, because as you'll hear in a bit, the recession passed almost unnoticed. And Nevada, because in front of the caucuses there this coming weekend, and dating back to the silver mines of the 1800s, it is no stranger to the cycle of booms and most recently busts. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner starts us off in Las Vegas.
Hey, Roy.
Mr. Cartwright. Mr. Cartwright. Doggone it, you won't have to worry about them critters of yours no more. The Thunderhead hit it big.
Bonanza. Now that was television. Ben Cartwright and his 3 rugged sons running the Ponderosa Ranch just a horse ride away from the rich Nevada silver mines, like the Thunderhead. Fictional Ben didn't always trust the local mining barons, but in real life, those guys founded Nevada. Guys who gambled big on finding a bonanza of silver or gold. Historian Bill Rowley says those men left a legacy of risk-taking here. It sounds bold and sexy, but it comes from desperation.
Because if you have a basically resourceless state and you're desperate, you're going to probably take more risk than you would otherwise do.
Mix in a feisty libertarian streak, and you've got a state full of people who like to gamble, and not just at the blackjack tables. Las Vegas entrepreneur Andrew Donner is betting on a revival of the city's old and, forgive me, sketchy downtown.
I'm really bullish on downtown.
Donner's company just bought the old City Hall building here for $18 million. He's going to rent the space to Zappos, the online shoe outfit. The idea? Get a hip company to move in, and bam.
I really do believe that it's almost impossible to move thousands of people downtown of the creative class and not have other things happen.
Nevada encourages this kind of chance-taking. No corporate income tax, no personal income tax. It's easy to get politicians and other power brokers on the phone. Nevada business consultant Jeremy Aguero.
There's also a regulatory environment that essentially allows a business owner the freedom to be a business owner with minimal interference from government.
Nevadans throw the word freedom around a lot, especially in Vegas, where they happily sell the idea of adult freedom to tourists. And whether freedom leads you to lose a couple thousand bucks at the casino or buy a big house you really can't afford, it's all sort of tolerated. Some here even call it an addiction to risk. Historian Michael Green.
You are taking the risk that you are going to find the gold. You are taking the risk that you are going to roll seven. And this reflects the economy today and what has gone right and now terribly wrong. The people who rolled the bones, so to speak, on a housing boom, and it went bust.
That bust has left Nevada with the highest jobless and foreclosure rates in the country. And even though the tourists are back, they're spending less. People got too greedy, folks here will tell you. They took on too much risk. But knowing how much is too much isn't always clear, says entrepreneur Andrew Donner. Donner's invested in casinos over the years but doesn't gamble. He saves that for business.
Well, you know, casinos, you somewhat know the odds, and I think that there is something beautiful about being somewhat ignorant of your odds out into the business marketplace. You keep working, and hopefully you win more than you lose.
In Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Thunder Herd's up $80 a share! Yay!
Hey, see what I mean? Hey, $80 a share, Bob.
Obviously, you have to have a certain something to thrive in Nevada. A tolerance for the economic booms and busts. In other places, though, a lot of other places, it's all about the even keel. Not getting too excited when things are going well, which helps when things elsewhere start going bad. Here's Marketplace's David Gura from Wayne, Nebraska, population 5,600.
Main Street cuts right through the center of this town, and this ain't the Strip. There's a movie theater on one end and a dollar store on the other. Small real estate agency sits catty-corner to a bank that was founded here back in 1892. Tricia Peters is a broker at First Realty. She says things slowed down some in 2008. She's seen a few homes in foreclosure, but not because the owners were gambling on the housing market.
We weren't going crazy with building. People were staying in their homes. They were trying to improve what they had.
Wayne is a farming town and a big one by Nebraska standards. There's a college here and a few factories. Peter says home prices have been stable. If you wanted to flip a house, this was not the place to do it.
Due to the size of our communities around here, people know when somebody buys a house for $80,000. And if they tried to turn around in 6 months from now and list it for $180,000, they would know something's up.
There wasn't really a housing bonanza in Nebraska. And because of that, there wasn't a housing bust. According to RealtyTrack, last year only 7 states had lower foreclosure rates. In this part of the country, if you want a loan, you'll need equity.
Our banks are pretty strict. You know, we've got some pretty straight shooters. Most of my clients are going through one of the 4 local banks here in the Wayne community.
The Midwest Land Company is right across the street. Marion Arneson is the owner. He's a farm manager and a land broker, and there's a deed on the wall to a piece of property that's still in Arneson's family, he tells me, 4 generations later.
You can talk all day, but Nebraskans have been through blizzards, they've been through heat. They're strong will, they're pioneer stock. They're going to have a couple down years, they just come back.
Arneson's clients are farmers, and their line of work is cyclical. Mark Landau is a political scientist and a Nebraskan born and raised.
When farmers have a bad year, it has a tremendous effect on the rest of the state.
When farmers have a good year, that has a tremendous effect too. This is, after all, the Cornhusker state. They've had a string of good years. The price of corn, the price of soybeans, they're through the roof. And farmers are making a lot of money. But the ones I talked to seemed so modest.
I think we see just a general conservatism, a general unwillingness to bite off more than you can chew, that is sort of the hallmark of the Nebraska personality.
Landau says that's what's called the Nebraska way.
That's the way we do things out here. We cooperate, we get together, we work things out.
Heritage Homes has a factory in Wayne, about a mile from Main Street. The company builds modular homes and ships them to states that aren't doing as well as Nebraska. It's a tough line of work to be in.
Housing usually leads us into recession and takes us out, but it just doesn't seem to be working quite as well that way.
That's Daryl Miller, who co-founded Heritage Homes in 1978. Last year, sales were down 40%, and there were layoffs. Competitors went out of business. But Miller has his eye on North Dakota, where there's an oil boom, and he's optimistic about the market.
We know it will come back. It just does.
That's the Nebraska way.
David Gura in the studio with us. Let me ask you this, though. Given that the economy in Nebraska is doing so well, how much do they really care about jobs and unemployment and all that stuff? Is it an issue for them in the election?
There's this sense that they've made it through this thing by virtue of grit, of course, through hard work, but also through luck. I mean, they can't control the price of corn, the price of soybeans, the price of beef, and it's those prices that have really been high enough to buoy the Nebraska economy. I think maybe it goes without saying that the health of that slice of the economy, the agricultural economy, is really important. And the Nebraskans I talked to say they really want the government to do all that it can to keep those strong, Kai.
Sarah Gardner, let me ask you this question then. The slug on your piece in our filing system was called Nevada Swagger, and that definitely came through in the piece. Is that enough to get them through, given what's going on there?
I think they've lost a little bit of that swagger.
Yeah.
They are very concerned about jobs and the housing market, of course. Although, realistically, they know that no politician is going to come in there, wave a magic wand, and their right. housing crisis is going to be solved overnight. They know they're in a deep hole there. I think what they are looking for, though, are some serious ideas about how to revive the national economy. Because if the national economy is doing well, if you and I are doing well, we've got bucks to go to Vegas
right.
and spend, and that helps their economy.
Right. Speaking of going to Vegas, we're there for the show on Friday in advance of the Nevada caucuses on Saturday. Let me ask you the reporter's notebook question then, Sarah. What sticks in your mind about this reporting trip you took?
What really surprised me was how much the state depends on tourism. Somebody said to me, you know, here in Nevada, we have a Blanche DuBois economy. We depend on the kindness of strangers.
Yeah.
And they really do. 58% of their state revenue comes from gambling and sales taxes.
Right.
And most of that comes from tourists.
David Gura, same question to you. What stuck with you?
You know, I'm going to sound like a real city slicker here, and I'm going to own that. But before I went to Nebraska, I had no sense of how vast, how big some of these farms are. And I had really had no sense of how high-tech farming has become. I mean, some of these guys have tractors with satellite radios and GPS, and you know,
wow.
they practically drive themselves. And those same farmers, the guys using that equipment, they're so plugged in to what's going on around the world, not just in Chicago and New York with the markets there, but with what's happening overseas. I mean, they could tell me all about what the weather's been doing in Argentina.
Wow.
And believe me, Kai, they did.
David Gura and Sarah Gardner and our election coverage. It's called The Real Economy. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
We've got interviews with more characters we met out on the road at our website. It's marketplace.org. Look for The Real Economy, as I said. It's our coverage of what matters this election cycle. On Wall Street today, kind of an session, actually, but a pretty nice January. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This was a big day in the finances of the presidential race. Candidates and the super PACs that support them independently and in a non-coordinated way, of course, have to report how much money they raised and spent last quarter. The chase for political contributions is a never-ending one, as you know, for big donors and small ones alike. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has more now on what campaigns are doing to bring in contributions from the little guys.
The last presidential election was all about online donations. This year, candidates are going mobile. Both the Obama and Romney campaigns are trying out a mobile payment system called Square.
First of all, it's incredibly easy for political campaigns to deploy.
Daniel Rubin is with Square. Here's what he means by easy. Campaign workers attach a card reader to a smartphone and download Square's special app. Then they hit the campaign trail, where they can easily collect donations from anyone with a credit card. Michael Malbin directs the Campaign Finance Institute. He says Square helps campaigns hit up supporters when emotions are high.
You know, before there's a chance for second thoughts, he says, do you support me? Yes. And at that moment, you say, click.
The app also collects information needed to comply with federal election commission rules. Carl Howe of the Yankee Group says this is a huge boost for Square. And it's not just because it takes a small fee every time you swipe.
They couldn't buy better advertising. They're implicitly getting an endorsement from the presidential candidates.
And the political campaigns are getting an app that can turn anyone with a smartphone into a fundraiser. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
If ever the remaining Republicans in the race had had a plan to fix the housing market, this would have been a really good week to roll it out. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index for November came out this morning. Not only did prices fall, they fell all the way back to where they were in 2003. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story.
Waiting for the housing market to improve can seem a little like waiting for Godot, except with more statistics. Today's statistics showed November home prices dropped in 18 out of 20 U.S. cities compared to the year before. Richard Green directs the Lusk Center for Real Estate at USC.
The Case-Shiller numbers are still pretty bad. People still don't have enough confidence to buy houses, but the other thing we're seeing is a lot of deals are getting broken up because people can't get financing.
And even if the banks loosen up and lend at historically low interest rates and more deals start closing, home prices are likely to stay low, says Glenn Kalman. He's the CEO of online real estate brokerage Redfin. He says that's because banks are sitting on a backlog of more than 1 million foreclosed homes.
No matter how many cereal boxes people want to buy, there will always be more boxes in the back room. So any chance of a price appreciation for the next probably 5 years is gone.
Still, Kalman expects we'll start to see a lot of buying and selling this year. And if that's the case, does it really matter if home prices don't rise? USC's Richard Green says yes.
You have a lot of people who are underwater right now, and they're stuck. And until they see some hope that they're going to get unstuck, I think it's very hard to have a roaring recovery.
More than a quarter of U.S. homeowners owe more on their houses than their houses are worth, which means they can't sell or buy. They just have to wait for prices to rise. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I have auditions, they go, not so pathetic. And I go, well, I was just being myself.
Making anxiety pay. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 20 points today, almost 0.2%, finished at 12,632. Still, the Dow had its best January in more than a decade. Let me say that again, more than 10 years. The S&P 500 dipped less than a point, a tiny fraction of 1%, closed at 1312. The NASDAQ managed to add a point, a fraction of a percent, to 2813, the number you're looking for there. Shares of ADM wilted 3.75% today. The agribusiness giant said quarterly earnings shrank to almost a tenth of what they were a year ago. In energy, shares of ExxonMobil drained off more than 2%. The world's biggest oil company reported favorable earnings, but said oil and gas production fell short of estimates. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.79%. Look out. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for December. Automakers are scheduled to release U.S. sales for January. And your kids play around in them, people collect recyclables in them, and they sit lost and lonely at curbsides. February is return shopping carts to the supermarket month. Think of it as good karma. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Poverty is one of those words that can be kind of vague in its application, used when maybe it's not exactly the right term. The government actually has a definition, the poverty line. But a report out today says that when you define poverty by assets and not by income as the government does, then a whole lot more people are poor, at least something called liquid asset poor. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein explains.
Ask Lois Matheson where she and her husband keep their money.
In a savings account, in a 401 account, in a retirement account of some kind, an annuity account.
That's liquid asset wealth, money you can get to when you need to, which is exactly what Matheson did after she lost her job back in 2010.
That was the first time that I thought, this is not a good situation. This is not something I want to be doing.
But for the past 16 months, the Mathesons have been dipping into their 35 years' worth of reserves because they can. A new report from the Corporation for Enterprise Development finds that many Americans cannot. The corporation's Andrea Levere.
43%, or almost half of this country, is living in liquid asset poverty.
That means some 50 million families don't have money to cover the basics for more than 3 months when faced with job loss. Income poverty, the typical definition of poverty, stands only at 15%. But that number doesn't tell the full story.
For too long, we focused simply on income. We didn't focus on savings and assets.
That's Ray Boshara with the Federal Reserve in St. Louis. Boshara says the benefit of liquid savings isn't just about weathering the storm.
You don't have to go to the check casher or the payday lender if you need some cash. It means you can open up a mainstream banking account. You can start a business. You also can make a down payment on a home.
Boshara says easy-to-grab cash helps determine who stays in poverty, who falls further behind, and who moves up. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The cover story of the latest issue of Fortune magazine is its annual list of the 100 best places to work. Salary, benefits, perks, intangibles, all the standard measurements. But commentator Teresa Amabile says there's something missing from the data.
The list might make you conclude that the best workplaces have fantastic perks and lots of fun every day. Sure, the techies at Google love the free gourmet food, and Zappos employees get a kick out of playing Nerf Dart War. But all of that misses the most important element of employee engagement, helping them succeed at work that matters. My research team and I analyzed nearly 12,000 work diaries from professionals in 7 different companies. We discovered something we call the progress principle. That may sound like management speak to you, but here's the thing. It really is all about management. The single most important thing that can keep workers deeply, happily engaged on the job is moving forward on work they care about, even if the progress is an incremental, small win. And the event that most often makes for a bad day at work? Feeling like you're being stalled. The negative effect of these setbacks on motivation and emotion is 2 to 3 times stronger than the positive effect of progress. Your bosses and how they manage you make all the difference. The best managers in our study paid attention to progress and supported it every day. They set clear goals and gave people autonomy in meeting those goals. As a result, their employees stayed committed, productive, and creative. Sure, cool perks are great. Who doesn't want gourmet food and game time? But it's the feeling of getting somewhere that keeps people jazzed about what they do at work. And that takes work.
Teresa Amabile is a professor at Harvard Business School. You can send us your thoughts about where you work or anything else you like. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on the link that says contact. You know how when you're watching TV, you see the same character actors cycling through in various different parts over the years? They're never quite famous, but they've been around forever, managing to make ends meet in an industry where most actors honestly don't. Fred Stoller is one of those guys. He's been on Everybody Loves Raymond, Seinfeld, and a whole bunch of others. He's been a stand-up comic and a sitcom writer. He's also now, thanks to Amazon's Kindle Singles, a best-selling author. His book is called My Seinfeld Year, about being on Jerry's writing staff for a year. Fred, thanks for coming by.
Oh, this is exciting. Thank you so much.
I have to tell you, it's a little weird because obviously I've seen you on television shows, Seinfeld and all the rest. And now you're sitting right here. And you know what's funny? You're exactly the same in person as you are on the television.
Which is wild.
Well, you're kind of a...
just a guy.
But more than that, don't take this the wrong way. You're kind of a schmo kind of guy.
Oh, I know that. One thing I say is I have auditions and they go, not so pathetic. And I go, well, I was just being myself. So there's something I exude that whatever.
I mentioned Seinfeld. The book is called My Seinfeld Year. Why? What was your Seinfeld year?
Well, you know the movie My Favorite Year?
Yeah, of course.
This was not that. It's what it was like being on the biggest sitcom, falling into a staff writing job, thinking maybe I'll have a real job, be a real person. And I was like the new guy asking, what do I do? How do I do this? I was just thrown into this, and I was like the weird pest kind of guy. So it was just kind of crazy behind.
Sounds not pleasant.
Well, it was pleasant in the fact I knew this was like TV history.
Yeah.
And I knew this was an amazing thing. But at the same time, that's why it was unpleasant, that this is supposed to be the biggest job to be on. And how do I make it work for me?
This book, it's a fascinating look at the guts of Seinfeld in 94, 95, right, when it was so big. But more than anything else, it's about you getting comfortable in your own skin of playing the same characters over and over.
Right.
And owning what you are in a professional sense.
Yeah, it's coming to terms because I was so naive. When I wrote on Seinfeld, I thought being a TV writer was a job. So
9 to 5, you go do your thing and you get paid,
right?
Yeah,
I thought this would be a nice job, save up money, get off the road. But people were very corporate. They had agents cultivating deals. And I'd be trying to write my Seinfeld scripts, and they'd be on the phone, these other guys, 3 deals ahead of themselves because of their Seinfeld cachet. I was naive. I was stupid.
Well, but you had...
I didn't even get a date from it.
But for all the angst and for all the anxiety that you have, in the world of working actors, you're doing amazingly well.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's L.A. where you see posters of people you started with. But yes, in perspective, it could be a lot worse, and I'm appreciative.
So now what? I mean, you're on the virtual bestseller lists, and you've got acting gigs sort of, you know, intermittently. Now what?
Well, still, I got a part in Fran Drescher's show coming up as an annoying waiter. So I'm still the annoying waiter, the annoying delivery guy. But this has been so fulfilling, the feedback I've been getting. So I hope to write more of these quirky singles or, I think, an actual book. And just I like expressing myself rather than fitting into puzzles.
Fred Stoller. His book is called My Seinfeld Year. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, Stephen Colbert of the Colbert Report on Comedy Central has, as you may know, started up his own super PAC, Americans for a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow. Well, along with all the other super PACs, they had to file financial reports with the FEC today. So herewith, a reading of the actual cover letter on Colbert's filing.
Dear Sirs and Sirettes, Americans for a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow, ABTT, would like it entered into the record that as of January 30th, 2012, the sum total of our donations was $1,023,121.24. Stephen Colbert, president of ABTT, has asked that I quote him as saying,
"Yeah! How do you like me now, FEC? I'm rolling 7 digits deep. I got 99 problems, but a non-connected independent expenditure-only committee ain't one."
I would like it noted for the record that I advised Mr. Colbert against including that quote. Sincerely, Shauna Polk, Treasurer, Americans for a Better Tomorrow Tomorrow, Inc.
$1 million for Stephen Colbert. Michelle Phillippe hooking us up there one more time. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow off 20. The NASDAQ off a point, the S&P 500 up a single point. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.